The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon here in Southern California. On the phone right now from Grantland.com, my friend Jonathan Abrams. What's happening?
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
You're on a cell phone, so there's going to be a slight delay here. I wanted to have you on for a variety of reasons, but mainly because the ESPN.com ombudsman wrote a piece yesterday about people who use Twitter avatars as a form of self-expression during the Trayvon Martin saga that's still going on, obviously. You were one of the writers who worked for ESPN. You were the only Grantland writer who changed their avatar to you in a hoodie, which I totally supported. The writer of the piece seemed to feel like the proper way for a journalist maybe to handle this situation was to write about it and, you know, remove their right to express themselves. I don't agree with that. I know you don't either. But what bothered me is that they never called you or emailed you to ask you why you made that decision. So I am giving you the forum right now. Tell us why you made that decision to change your avatar.
Well, to me, this wasn't that much of a sports story. It was a human story. Obviously, the Miami Heat took a team picture, and that kind of transformed it into the sports world a little bit. But for the most part, it people who have been showing their sympathies toward this kid. And for me, I'm a 28-year-old black guy, and what really resonates for me is that, you know, this could have been me. This could have been one of my friends just unarmed walking down the street and confronted by somebody bigger than them with a gun. And was I going to write a story about that? I don't know how. Obviously, Jamila was able to write a story about that. I didn't see how ESPN could do, 50 different stories on something that really didn't touch along sports. And I wanted to find a way to show some solidarity because this, I mean, nothing has really gnawed at me like this has. You know, I just feel for him, and I know it could be, any one of my friends or me.
And also, this didn't really become a sports story, I don't feel like, until the end of last week. I mean, do you feel like this was a sports story until the Miami Heat thing happened?
No, I mean, I still don't feel that it's a sports story. The Miami Heat showed their human interest side more than anything. They weren't trying to make a basketball statement, just like, Barack Obama, when he commented on it. He wasn't trying to talk about sports or anything. He was talking about how it affected, him, and that Trayvon could look like his own son. So it's more just, do I have a right, I guess, as a person to comment on this, out of my journalistic form, and I felt I had the right to do so.
Yeah, well, obviously I agree with you. And, I think that's the part that I felt the ombudsman piece missed, and I don't mean to be the ombudsman for our ombudsman, but I don't think somebody is a journalist 24 hours a day. I think we're human beings who do what we do for a living. And, my life is, I am the editor-in-chief of Grantland. I'm in charge of the people that work for it. I'm in charge of the writers that work for it. I write sports columns. I do this podcast. I'm in charge of my family. But that, I'm doing a variety of things, and I just don't think that you have that green light on 24 hours a day that you're a journalist. As you said, this was a human story. And, I think also, like, you're on Twitter. You're representing ESPN to some degree, but to some degree you're also representing yourself, I feel like, right? It's two sides of Jonathan.
I'm purposely bland on Twitter because I know, the power of it. And I know, whatever I tweet can get out there. And I debated a long time about tweeting this. I actually don't know why people follow me because I'm still bland, but I knew that that this would gain some momentum, and I wanted people to think about it. The tweet I put was that, you know, that I had worked at the LA Times and New York Times, now Grantland and ESPN, and what would Trayvon have been if he had been given the chance? And, you know, I showed myself in a hoodie, and
yeah,
you know, to a lot of people, that picture would be scary. You know, I took it on purpose because I knew it would be scary to people. You know, I wasn't in a business suit or how I would show up to a game. But, you know, I just want people to see that, you know, sometimes the outside doesn't reflect what's on the inside.
Yeah, and for me, you know, I've only known you for about a year. And you are not somebody who likes the limelight that much. I mean, ideally, you would never like to be part of any story. You're not somebody who's Mr. Self-Expression. I would say you're the quietest of any writer that we have. So for you to do this avatar thing, I felt like was a pretty big thing for you. Did you hesitate doing that, or it was no question you were doing it?
Yeah, no, I hesitated for a while. I would have did it a couple days earlier, but I was on the road and I didn't have a sweatshirt. But it was something I debated back and forth, and more stuff came out about, you know, the Trayvon being on the phone with his girlfriend and all the phone calls that Zimmerman had made to the police and the racial epithet that Zimmerman used. And, you know, I just felt like I had to do something, and I wasn't, you know, I knew I wasn't going to write a story for it because I didn't feel like it was a sports story, but I still felt that I had to do something. And I went to journalism school at USC. I worked for, you know, some of the biggest newspapers, and you know, I realized separating the person from the story and the need for that, you know, that's drilled into me. I hesitate. I even now I hate using I when I write. But I knew I wasn't going to write a story on this, and I also knew how much it affected me personally, how much it affected the people close to me, and I just wanted to come out and make a statement.
Do you think that we should have written something about it last week?
You know, I racked my brain trying to pitch something, trying to see how it could be, but once Jamila wrote that story, I didn't know kind of what else to do story-wise that I could have done.
Yeah.
Maybe there was a way, but I still don't think it's a sports story. It's a human interest story more than anything else.
This happened on February 26th. When did this go on your radar?
My fiance talked about it to me maybe a week into March, and then when it really started to affect me was when I read Charles Blow's column on it in the New York Times.
When was that?
That was in the middle of March.
Yeah. Why do you think this took so long? What's your take on that?
You know, I'm still not sure. It's almost like the Imus thing. That took a little time to really gain traction and make it into the mainstream and get picked up.
Right.
But and I also think that once more of it came to light, you know, all the phone calls that Zimmerman had made and stuff like that, that's when people really started getting kind of fed up that there's been no justice for this kid yet.
Right. You know, it's 2012, and it, you know, we're in such a better place with racism and just everything in general than we were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And yet, it seems like every once in a while, this stuff just pops up. And as soon as it pops up, it's like this scab that gets ripped open. And I think that's, you know, you were only probably, what, 12, 11 or 12 during the OJ trial? How old were you during the OJ trial? 13?
Probably about then. I was still mad about it because my dad, he promised to take me to a Dodger game when the OJ car chase came on. So I was still pretty mad about that.
Well, you know, I think that this was a little bit similar in that the OJ trial became about something else. And all this stuff that had been festering for a while that nobody was really talking about that much just kind of festered and came out and bubbled over. And that became just as big as the trial itself. And, you know, I think you look at life now in 2012, we have a president who's biracial, you know, and it would be very easy to think, oh, yeah, none of this stuff is really kind of gone away. It's not as big of a deal. And then something like this happens. And don't you feel like that played into as much of a part of this as anything? that it was almost like, yeah, this stuff's still festering. Don't think it's not.
I mean, it needs a spark like this for people to take a good look at it. But, I mean, I know the looks I get, you know, when I go places. I've lived in the same apartment building for about 4 years now, and I'm the only young black guy who lives here, and I still, you know, get looks sometimes like, what are you doing here? I mean, it's an everyday thing. I think, you know, now we just kind of live with it. We don't expect it to be the extreme of Trayvon, but, you know, that's like I said, that's the main thing that sticks out, is that just every young black person, I think male especially, realizes that they could have been in that same position as him.
Yeah. So, you know, when you saw something like the way Miami reacted to this, did you feel like, you know, you said it was a human decision. Did you feel like, you know, you look at just, I keep going back to like the way they handled the decision and stuff like that and some of the self-promotion that team had. And yet, I felt like this was 100% genuine, the reasons for why they did it and how they executed and everything. Did you feel like it was 100% genuine?
Yeah, I did. And I'll be honest, I felt proud of LeBron because of that. I asked myself in my head, could I ever picture Michael Jordan doing something like that? And I don't think he would have, you know, not to put down Michael. But, you know, LeBron was stepping out on a ledge, and so were all the Heat when they did this. And, you know, it just shows a mark of solidarity that I think is, you know, appreciative all around.
Yeah. Yeah, I was proud of LeBron, too. It sounds weird and condescending to say that, but you're right. Jordan was the guy who said, you know, Republicans buy sneakers too, or whatever he said. And I don't know if he takes a stand, but then again, that was a different generation. And, you know, LeBron's of a generation where you express yourself more. People express themselves through Twitter, through tattoos. Like, you know, there's all these different things that are in place now that, that really weren't in place back then. Where do you see this going over the next, 2 weeks as a sports story, or is this just going to die out as a sports story and continue as a human story?
Yeah, I see it dying out as a sports story. I never really saw it as one to begin with, unless, you know, the way Jamila did in her story, she, you know, tied it into how it affected them. And I don't know what you can do almost sports-wise to tie it in beyond that. You know, I do see it still being covered, especially diligently in major newspapers and online, because there has to be some type of resolution here. You would hope that, you know, his family sees justice eventually.
How long do you plan on keeping the avatar?
No, that's a good question. When I put it up, I didn't have any type of you know, end date for it. Maybe until he gets arrested, I'm not sure, but. You know, it's funny because I also changed my Facebook picture, and I had, you know, a couple of my friends get in touch with me saying that they almost unfriended me because they didn't recognize me.
Right. Last month you did, just switching gears quickly, you did a whole oral history on the Artest Melee, which ended up being, I think, 14,000 words, something like that. And the most compelling character in the piece, although Jermaine O'Neal was pretty good, but Steven Jackson, I remember you emailed us right after you interviewed him, and you had gotten him, I think, for like 45 minutes, and you'd expected it to be maybe 5 or 10. And, well, you can describe it, but you said it was like he had been waiting for years to talk about this with somebody. Is that accurate?
Yeah, no, Steven was great for that. It was funny because I heard him coming. I was in the – it was at Madison Square Garden, and I heard him coming around the corner before I actually saw him, and I heard him saying, I love talking about the bra. I love talking about the bra. You know, I thought he was kind of being condescending in that, you know, he'd give me one or two quotes and then be on with his day. But he was telling the truth. He had been waiting to talk about that story for a long time. And, you know, you worked with me close on that piece. It was a struggle getting people to talk before Steven really opened up on it. And then once we got Steven to talk and kind of shed some light on that night, you know, the story just really opened up after that.
We almost gave up. I mean, it had gotten to the point where if that Jackson interview hadn't come through, I think that was it. We were just going to kind of fold shop. We couldn't get anybody. And then it became like a little bit of of a domino effect. But man, I'll never forget that getting that email from you, because it really seemed like that door just closed. And then, you know, it was funny. Not everybody talked. Like Reggie Miller, for some reason, wouldn't talk. Rick Carlisle had no interest in being involved. Who was the other one who wouldn't talk? Our test. Now Metta World Peace.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one.
Which I guess he wouldn't talk for, you know, he had talked about it a bunch of times, and he's trying to be in a different point in his life, but it would have been nice to get his take now. But Jackson, one of the things that was, you know, speaking of the word festering, one of the things festering in that piece was, seemed like he had some real bitterness toward our test for everything that had kind of transpired. He felt like he went out in the stands to protect his teammate, and once it was over, his teammate kind of abandoned him, right?
Right. That's what really affected Stephen and Jermaine, was when Ron asked to be traded. They felt like, you know, he put them in a bad situation. He ruined that season for them. And then he asked to be traded the next year.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if Jackson and Artest are ever going to cross paths on a basketball court. I mean, we could see a San Antonio Lakers series with those guys guarding each other.
That would be great. Because Stephen said they never talked about it.
And seems relatively bitter about it. Did you hear from anybody after that piece? Did you hear any stories or anecdotes that you wished after the fact we could have thrown in there?
Well, one thing that I heard afterwards was that Matt Dobek, who used to be the Pistons...
trainer.
The Pistons public relations guy. He testified or something that when our test was lying on the scorer's table, he heard him tell Ben Wallace, "You can lick my, you know what." And
that kept it going?
I saw that afterwards.
No wonder Ben Wallace is so mad.
Yeah.
We couldn't really get Ben Wallace to talk either.
Yeah, beyond, I hope everybody learned from that. You know, it's still a sensitive topic for a lot of people. A lot of people feel like their careers were ruined by that night. You know, Reggie never got a chance at his ring. Jamal Tinsley's career really went south after that. A lot of people are still feeling the ill effects of that night.
Yeah, and, you know, it's something we'd always talked about as a 30 for 30 documentary. And we can't do it for obvious reasons, because the NBA controls the footage. And that's a night that they probably want to go away. And even we had trouble getting Mr. Stern to go on the record, because he had no interest in us doing that story. Eventually, once it became clear it was done and we were putting it up, we got a quote out of him. But I think, unfortunately, that oral history is going to be the only account of that night, because I don't think there will ever be a documentary about it. I don't think the NBA will ever allow it to happen. What they should do is they should allow it to happen, because, you know, you could spin it into something of a positive. You know, I think it changed the way fans are allowed to act at games. It put up better barriers between the players and the fans. I think, you know, when you look at what happened to the Pacers, they're certainly in a better place. Maybe the Pistons aren't, but that had more to do with front office decisions than anything. But
yeah, you know, the story I just got done reading was the punch with Kermit Washington and Rudy T. And, you know, it kind of reminds me about that. A big, you know, at the time, well, still now it's a negative thing, but it helped change the NBA for the better.
Right. Yeah, maybe. Hey, when did they do that doc? That documentary was probably like 25 years after the punch. I think that's when the book happened too. So maybe 25 years ago. You have a head start on the book though, because you did like, how many hours of interviews did you do for that?
Oh my gosh. I think when we were ready to turn it in, I had about 100 pages worth of interviews.
Oh God. Last thing you wrote about, last thing you wrote on Grantland about, trades. About players who have been traded and how different just that we never realize what a weird experience that is for somebody to be living in one place one minute with their girlfriend, and the next minute you're like, hey, you're going to Cleveland. What was your favorite thing you learned when you were researching that story?
I think that Luke Walton, one of the main reasons he wanted his girlfriend to stay in Los Angeles when he got traded to Cleveland was to be able to watch their dog, which I thought was pretty funny. But, I mean, I like those type of stories, and I think you do too, is kind of looking at guys from a human interest standpoint. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that these guys' lives are really affected at the, you know, drop of a dime. You know, they may have money to make the move pretty seamless, but they're often leaving places where they've really made roots and, you know, have families and stuff along those lines.
Right. And you've done you did a whole thing. You followed the Knicks, right, for at least a couple seasons you were on the road for them?
Yeah.
It's pretty grim. It's a lot of, like, just people on airplanes and people in their headphones and then people in their rooms by themselves, and then you go to practice for an hour. And, you know, I think the days, like, you read a book like Breaks of the Game or something like that, and, you know, from the 70s or the 80s when these teams were really together. And, you know, they ate after games with reporters and things like this. And now it just seems like there's a disconnect. At least, you know, it's just too easy to get lost in your own world now. It's a weird way to live, these guys. Especially, like, you think, like, they're on these chartered planes. You know, it seems perfect. They're in hotel suites, but yet they're alone a lot more than you kind of realize, right?
Right. And that was one of the things I talked to Richard Jefferson about, you know, his trade to Golden State. You know, I asked him, how do you fit into a new team? And he said, you really don't have to. You know, all you do is playing basketball. You're not going out to eat with these guys after games, or you're not hanging out or trying to become best friends. It's just, you know, whatever you do on the court matters.
Right, which isn't the way sports is really supposed to work for the most part. Usually you want these guys to be tight off and on and off the court. Anyway, all right, Abrams, thanks for coming on the BS Report. We're going to call Rembert.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's go to another young Grantland writer who is also living in New York. It's his birthday today. For his birthday, I'm getting him a podcast appearance on the BS Report. Rembert Brown, what's happening?
I'm good. I'm 25. I made it. I'm good.
25. That was a great age. I miss being 25. That was my favorite. One of my favorite birthdays. 25. We want to have you on because we just talked to Abrams about his decision to change his Twitter avatar to reflect what was going on with the Trayvon Martin case. You made the decision not to change your Twitter avatar. Explain to us why.
Being in New York, I sort of have taken part in a couple Trayvon Martin related activities. There was this big Million Hoodies March where, like, thousands and thousands of people met up in Union Square. They had the option of wearing hoodies and sort of took over Union Square in Midtown Manhattan by way of a march. And I remember en route there, I was coming from something else where I had a suit on, and sort of made the last-minute decision to run home, grab a black hoodie, and run down to Union Square for this. And not really sure why, but I just at the time it felt right. And
yep.
I was pleased that I did that because there are a lot of people around with hoodies. And so I was happy with that, you know, sort of as a sign of solidarity. But I didn't really, just as I saw sort of the hoodies popping up on people's avatars, and I saw the whole heat thing and everything, I guess it was a mixture of partly feeling like I didn't want to do it sort of 10 days into everyone else doing it, and partly it didn't seem as important of a statement to make as enough for me to really want to change my picture. Not that I'm, like, super, you know, obsessed with my current picture. But
wow, it's a pretty nice picture.
Isn't
plus, you were probably thinking about writing something about it potentially, right? And part of the problem with this story is it's not, you know, for our purposes, it's not, we concentrate mostly on sports and pop culture and things like that. It didn't really fit into the kind of stuff we're churning out. I asked Abrams this, so I'm going to ask you, do you feel like we made a mistake not writing about it last week?
You know, I think there definitely was an opening to write something about it. I don't see it as a mistake because I think there were a couple places that sort of took a sports angle that wrote about it really well, so well that I didn't really, I felt like I almost would have been repeating some of what I read. And
yeah.
So, you know, that was one of the reasons that, you know, when it, like, whenever something that's not directly sports related but can have an angle pops into the public consciousness, like, it immediately sort of sparks my attention as, like, not a, just a straight up sports writer. But it, you know, I think we could have done it, and it would have been a really, it would have been a good move, but I don't necessarily see it as a 100% failure to report on all the news, you know.
I think for, I said this earlier, but I think it was more of a timing thing from our end. Like, we published from Monday through Friday. The Heat thing kind of became a story on Friday, you know, and then by Monday,
yeah,
all the stuff had kind of been written about it. We just would have been piggybacking it, although, you know, now that the more I think about it, I do wish we had done something. I'm just not sure what the idea would have been. I wouldn't want to do an idea that I'd already seen.
Yeah.
But then the ombudsman posted something yesterday and criticized Abrams and a couple other writers for changing their avatar as a form of self-expression. She thought it was basically, you know, kind of a lazy way to handle it, and that if you were going to speak out on this, you should, you know, write about it or report it or whatever. Do you agree with that or you disagree?
You know, I mean, I definitely think that writing about stuff and sort of participating in the dialogue is definitely, I think participating in the dialogue does have, bring more net gain than just, you know, changing your picture in a form of solidarity. But, you know, I, as someone that made the conscious decision to not change my picture to me in a hoodie, I can't even imagine actually looking down on someone in the writing world or any other sphere for doing that. You know, I mean, it's not, it's really not my place to say at all how someone else expresses themselves. Especially, you know, when I saw the Heat thing for the first time, my initial gut reaction was like, you know, unfortunately, my initial reaction was, this sort of seems like a little publicity stunt-ish a little bit. Like, my initial reaction wasn't that positive, and then I thought about it, and I sort of thought about, you know, if the shooting happened a month ago, and we're still talking about it, and one of the reasons we're still talking about it is because more and more public figures are, you know, showing signs of solidarity by putting hoodies on doing that, and, you know, no, regardless of what the initial motives are, if this wasn't happening over and over and over again, the case might be a lost, you know, topic of discussion by now. So, you know, I don't really have an issue with Abrams or any other writers that have a platform doing it.
Yeah, I felt the same way as you did about Miami when I first heard of it. I was skeptical, but the skepticism was more because of how they had handled other things over the last 2 years, you know?
And yeah.
I was like, oh, man, now these guys are interjecting themselves. And then you read about it and you read the reasoning and you really take a step back and think about it. And I feel the same way about the Twitter avatars. I don't think everybody should do it. I never would have even considered doing that, but I think for certain people, especially younger people, and especially if you're young and black, I mean, I totally get it, and I support it.
Well, yeah,
obviously.
You know, my mom posted, just for my birthday, my mom posted a picture on Facebook because she, like, now knows how to use it. She posted a picture of me when I was 16 on Facebook, and, like, you know, no facial hair, very, very baby face, and when I saw that picture, I had just been reading something about Trayvon Martin and, like, had that image sort of in my head, and, you know, looking at myself at that same age, you know, it really sort of messed with my head a little bit. And because, I mean, it had been the entire time, you know, just like being still a young black male, like that still being like a very sort of, being a young black male is still a dangerous thing to be, apparently, in the States, unfortunately. And just seeing that picture of myself that young and thinking about this case sort of for the past month really sort of took me for a whirl. And, you know, I wouldn't have a problem if I saw a bunch of 40-year-old white dudes throwing up hoodies in their avatars and, you know, claiming to do that as a sign of solidarity, I wouldn't find it that weird as a 25-year-old black guy. But at the same time, I can understand if I was in that position, I would probably be a little sort of on guard for any criticism that would come my way from others, you know.
Where do you stand on Jay Kang, who I think his Twitter avatar and Facebook avatar was always him in a hoodie?
Yeah.
I don't know. You just kind of had to ride that, I guess. He's always in it.
Yeah.
He's pulled over.
Well, that was the thing I liked about Abrams. Like, he sent out a tweet saying, like, I wear hoodies. Like, this is sort of my thing, but I also,
right.
You know, it makes it seem like, it gives the point. Like, this is, yes, this is sort of an act of solidarity, but it's, like, also not an act. Like, this is actually me sort of expressing how I really feel, and, like, I'm really invested in this. In this case and everything. So I thought that was, you know.
Yeah.
I like
when,
it.
When did this go on your radar? Because the shooting happened on February 26th. When did you find out about it? And when did you start wondering why more people weren't talking about it?
I found out about it actually the next day because a friend of mine, I have a couple friends, especially one very close friend that sort of works in organization in Brooklyn that specializes in community, like, violence in the community in Crown Heights that she lives in. And so she deals with sort of Trayvon Martin cases, you know, on a monthly basis almost, you know, like, talking to her this morning before you called me, she had actually told me about, you know, sort of a homicide that had happened in the neighborhood with some of the kids they were working with just yesterday. And, you know, so she put me on the radar to it. I wondered if it would just, because it was in Florida, I didn't know if it was going to be national news, if it was just sort of fade away like so many things do in, you know, a day or two. But I was pleasantly surprised how much attention it got. And even though I've been sort of back and forth about some of the displays of attention, and, you know, being in New York, there's this whole Occupy movement that is sort of putting themselves in the middle of this, which, depending on how you feel about that, is either doing some good or some bad for the Trayvon case in terms of how they're mobilizing. But, I mean, I've been thinking about it pretty much since it happened, and I was very cynical from the get-go because I didn't think that the attention would last this long.
And you're also somebody, you kind of fell into writing for us because, well, tell people what, initially you almost were the head writer for, what was it? Which Obama blog was it? Obama.
Yeah,
Obama
I was in the running to be one of the main bloggers for the Obama campaign. And that was also while I was in grad school for urban planning. So, you know, I'm sort of I guess by training or by initial passion, a policy person with a specialty in, you know, urban policy. So, you know, this world is very much the type of stuff that I'm still very, very invested in. Even, you know, as I write, you know, something about R. Kelly for Grantland on a on a Friday, I'm still thinking about and reading about, you know, everything that happens. And I have a lot of friends that are still in that world. So that's, you know, when stuff happens like this, you know, it really, like, it still really impacts, like, sort of my feelings from day to day and, like, how I think about the world. And, you know, as someone that's seen stuff like this happen, I was hoping, like, maybe this will be the case that really sort of gets everyone's attention and, like, we really start thinking about this stuff instead of thinking that it's just like sort of like, oh, this is a Trayvon Martin thing, like this happened, but, you know, it's sort of an isolated incident, you know, this type of stuff happens all the time. But yeah, so I'm, you know, it's a tragedy, but you hope that from stuff like this, some widespread awareness comes.
When you say seeing things like this happen, do you feel like there was another incident that happened, you know, within the last couple of years that kind of got swept under the rug or wasn't covered the way it should have been covered?
I mean, I feel like because I keep pretty good tabs with, you know, being from Atlanta, you know, I still read the Atlanta Journal-Constitution like every day online. I hear about local news happening in New York. I really like the mayor of Newark, Cory Booker. So like I follow sort of what's happening over there. Like I hear about cases involving whether it's some very vague form of police brutality or just, you know, kids shooting each other or neighborhood violence or, you know, like having this friend that works for this organization in Brooklyn where she, you know, she sort of, you know, has really good days when no violence happens, has really bad days when something bad happens, you know, and, you know, when we talk, you know, I often think like, wow, like that should be a really major story. Like everyone should know about this. It shouldn't just be me finding out because you told me because you had a bad day and like needed to vent. And then it like never gets on the news. So, you know, I can't really like pinpoint a specific case that I think should have been blown out of the water more, but you know, this isn't this case with Martin isn't like the first of its kind or like the first act of violence that should have, you know, gotten a lot of attention.
So where do you see this? How do you see this playing out? You mentioned that you thought maybe this could go in a direction where people could get a little overly self-righteous. People could turn this into something that veers in a different direction than maybe what the cause should be. What's your prediction for the next couple months?
Well, so you know, this morning, you sort of had the, like we had like the entertainment world with, they had their 2 weeks of, you know, throwing up hoodies and like giving their solidarity and everything. And now it's starting to get into sort of like the political world. There have been a couple congressmen that have like gone to the House floor with hoodies on, like under their suits. That happened this morning with Bobby Rush, who used to be a Black Panther, which is like a whole nother thing because Black Panthers like offered a $10,000 like pretty much bounty on Jennifer's head. You know, I mean, to like pretty much find him and bring him to them. But you know, they, you know, as it sort of gets into, I feel like phase two, which is, you know, politicians that sort of coming out and giving their 2 cents and doing the thing with the hoodies and everything. You know, I think that will extend the conversation. And, you know, I've unfortunately gotten a little bit jaded with politics over the past few years, even though I used to want to be one, a politician. And, you know, I want to think that it's all, you know, it's all for the betterment of the movement or awareness and everything. And I, you know, I'm trying to, I'm not completely sold on it yet, but you know, if anything, you know, it's going to keep, even if it's people coming out saying that they don't agree with, you know, politicians coming to the House floor with hoodies on, like it's at least going to keep the conversation going, I think, for another, you know, maybe through April. You know, I think a lot of it depends on like what the hell happens to that guy Zimmerman. Like if he, you know, if he just walks forever, you know, I think the outrage will continue. And if he, something happens and he gets brought in or, you know, charged with something, then it, that might be seen as the victory and it might die down. So I don't know. I think it, you know, I think it still has some legs and, you know, I hope that it just doesn't, you know, by June, people aren't like, who is Trayvon Martin? You know, I hope, you know, his sort of like name doesn't just like die in vain like that. But it's hard to tell because, you know, something else could happen in the next 2 weeks that just diverts everyone's attention and, you know, it becomes a complete non-factor for discourse anymore. So I don't know.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's how society works sometimes. Something becomes a story, then it becomes like a mainstream story, then it goes into a couple different directions, and everybody gets what they can get out of it, and then it kind of dies off because the next story came along. And it'll be interesting to see if that happens here.
I was just one last thing. I was actually talking with someone the other day about, you know, if it made it as far as, you know, if it made it through the summer, like to the Olympics or something like that, like if you'd get like Olympic athletes, you know, going to the podium and like with like a hoodie on or something like that, like how far could it go in terms of people? Could that, you know, that's, I think it all depends on like what stages are there for people to, for people to display themselves. Like, you know, you have like the internet and people doing it there, and you know, you have, you know, marches and other things, but like these highly televised events, I feel like that's another realm where it hasn't really, it hasn't, the sort of hoodie movement hasn't really gotten there yet. And I'm just curious to see, you know, at the next major event, sporting event or whatever event, like if it still has enough steam to carry that far.
That's pretty interesting. I didn't think about that. So let's see. The NBA Finals, I would say, is the most likely candidate for something like that to happen. Or yeah, maybe even the Eastern Conference Finals, and you could be in a situation where, let's say, Miami wins the Eastern Conference title. They actually have the trophy ceremony, which everybody forgets. That could be a situation where they all go hoodie. Or the finals would be another thing.
They've already set the precedent, you know.
Right. I don't see it happening in hockey. I think the Olympics, though, is a place, like you think about back to 1968.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, maybe that would keep going.
Yeah, you think of the trophy ceremony, you think of, you know, maybe, you know, on that, on the opening ceremonies, you know, loop that they do in the stadium. You know, I think, you know, I'm not that optimistic that it's going to make it. When are the Olympics? June?
Olympics are end of July.
Make it that far, but you know, there's no way to really know.
Do you feel like this is wherever this movement goes, do you think it's exclusive to African Americans?
It's one of those things that because I still don't think the culture really knows how to talk about race that well and openly and comfortably, it shouldn't be. I don't think it should be. You know, while it is a particularly a very race-fueled incident, I've not from day one, I haven't thought like this was, you know, this was our issue to only get worked up about, and like it's only our issue to comment on, and it's only our issue to, you know, sort of seek justice about. You know, I not only do I think that's, you know, utilizing like a small percentage of the resources that could be used in terms of, you know, making this a massive issue, but you know, it's, you know, while you know, you have a young black kid that got gunned down by a guy who is, you know, half white, half, I think, some like Latino, I think it's Peruvian or something like that. Like
Venezuelan, yeah.
Yes, the race issue is already out there. Like that's, when you go to the Wikipedia page of Trayvon Martin, you know, the first line is like African American boy gunned down by, you know, non-black person. Like, it's already out there. But I don't think that, I've never thought that this was a thing that, you know, that only we can, like, only we have the right to give our two cents about. And
right.
I feel like that's a very old tactic that needs to die out, because that's just not how, this is not how things work anymore, I think, for better. And yeah.
No, it's a good point. I know you weren't crazy with the dismount, but you made the point. It was good. Sometimes I'm going to be late or miss the boat or not totally appreciate where a story's going, you know, especially if it's not a sports story. I didn't even know. You know, my life is so concentrated right now toward just dealing with the site and figuring out what's going on with sports. Sometimes I don't even know what's going on. And I didn't even know about this shooting until I think 4 days after it happened.
Yeah.
But to watch it blossom into the story that it's become and then watch it cross over into sports has been pretty fascinating. And, you know, this is weird, but I have come away liking LeBron James' work because of this. Like, it's a weird thing to say, but I don't feel like he did it for the attention or because, you know, it was, put it this way, it was the opposite of why the decision happened.
You know what I mean? Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
I feel like their intentions were the right intentions, and I'm glad they did it, and I'm glad that this became a sports story because, you know, I think that's the best thing about sports sometimes is the way it interacts with everything else that's going on in our lives. So,
it was one of the first times I thought about LeBron and Wade, you know, as, you know, fathers. You know, I think about them thinking like reading this story and like looking at all these little black boy kids that they have and like actually being, you know, impacted by that. And, you know, as someone that is, you know, very much goes back and forth with like LeBron as the off the court human that he is, like it just not really ever feel like I've gotten a real glimpse into how he thinks about the world. You know, I did do like a very similar quick turnaround in terms of sort of their motives about that, especially, you know, the two of them.
Do you think that one of the reasons we have such a problem talking about race openly is because so many people are just afraid to, you know, it's almost like you're walking on eggshells all the time. Even like me today doing this podcast, like, you know, it's always in the back of your head. It's like, oh, I got to say this carefully. I got to say this perfectly. And don't you feel like that feeds into this a little bit? Now people end up not saying anything.
Yes. The short answer is yes, but part of it, you know, I think it's one of the few things that I think is extremely generational. You know, I sort of, myself growing up, talking about race ended up going to sort of a diverse school and sort of straddling like sort of like the black world and the white world of sort of segregated Atlanta. I grew up having race discussions in my curriculum at school. So by the time I got to, you know, the real world, I've been sort of openly talking about race in mixed company for like almost a decade. You know, it's very comfortable to me now. I don't think that my first thing that pops into my head is not, oh, I don't want to offend anyone. It's like, oh, I just want to, you know, make an educated point and hope that, you know, sort of impacts the way someone thinks about something. But, you know, when I talk to some elder members of my family or my mom, for instance, and she discusses, you know, the think tank that she works in and sort of talking about race in a mixed crowd with that's mixed generations, she often describes it the same way you are. It's like, everyone's sort of worried about pissing someone off and saying the wrong thing and, like, God forbid, being labeled as a racist, which, you know, is, like, the worst thing in the world.
Or not even that. It's just, like, you know, you phrase a sentence the wrong way and all of a sudden it's like, well, what did he really mean by that? What were his real intentions? Yeah. You know, and it's – and I do think that can be counterproductive sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a, you know, a faction of people that are, you know, sort of just waiting for someone to say the thing that could be, you know, phrase, like, could it be interpreted as, oh, they said this, but they probably meant it that way. You know, like, those people are out there, which obviously doesn't help, you know, discussions of race progress. But, you know, I do think, you know, I think it's true that, you know, a lot of people's go-to about race discussion is to just say nothing at all because they'd rather not offend anyone than to, like, you know, say something great that like five people like, but two people are offended by. They'd rather just sort of go dark on the issue, you know?
Well, and then something, you know, like what happened to Geraldo Rivera, who got rightfully piled on because he was an idiot. But at the same time, the extent of how people came after him almost kind of exceeded the crime of what he said, you know, and it really seemed like people are just gleefully looking for any sort of pinata to jump on. And
oh, yeah.
They're like, oh, look at this idiot. He said something dumb.
He's the perfect scapegoat. I mean, it almost seemed like he wanted to be. It was so ridiculous. But, you know, in situations like that, I mean, everyone sort of, with this case, has been dying to find a scapegoat. And because, like, it can't be this dude, Zimmerman, who sort of has gone off the grid, you know, when anyone comes out and says something that's slightly offensive, you know, like I'm really, you know, I was really sort of put off by about what Rivera said, because I just thought it was, you know, based on nothing and like ignorant. But there is like a small part of me that's like, I'm sort of glad he said something just because it got people, you know,
right,
like sort of riled up and talking again. There's always a little good in someone just like saying some really dumb stuff, because at least it gets people sort of talking about the issue, and it's not just a completely one-sided thing. So, I mean,
yeah, it was like throwing another log in the fire. And
yeah,
you know, exactly. I thought what he said was reprehensible, but I'm not sure he should be in the first paragraph of every Martin story from this point on, which is where it seemed to be for a couple of days. I thought it kind of obscured the bigger
message of the whole
story.
Yeah.
Anyway, we agree. All right, Rember Brown, how are you spending your birthday?
I'm going to clean up my room, and then I'm going to It just stopped raining, so I'm going to hang out in New York, and then I'm having a birthday party tonight, and it's going to be great.
Birthday party?
Birthday party, yeah.
Try to stay out of trouble for once.
I will.
See, it's bad weather there. You got to move to L.A. We've been trying to get you. I told you I have a guest room for you. You can live with the Simmons family.
I'm coming in 2 weeks. Yeah, I'll just bring a sleeping bag, or I'll just sleep on your floor. You don't have much space.
It could be like one of those bad 80s sitcoms that we make you watch and write things about on how to prospect this for us.
Yeah.
All right. Enjoy your birthday. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
We will talk to you
of
soon.
Of course. Absolutely. Before I get the
sound off. Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.